are celebrating 20 years of 24. And our special guest today, we're very excited about this. Our special guest today is Sprague Graydon, as you know from season 7 of 24, and caused a little bit of chaos. had some agendas going on. There's so many things that she's been involved with that I can geek out about. And I'm Ryan, this is Justin, and we'd like to welcome you, Sprague, to the show.
Thank you. Hi, Ryan.
Welcome.
Hi,
Justin. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely.
So, you know, the question we always ask our guests is, how'd you get involved with 24 in season 7? What was your experience like playing Olivia Taylor on season 7 and working with all the writers and all the other actors you worked with on that season?
Sure. So how I got the job is actually a pretty good one. They had already cast someone else who shall remain nameless, but she got another job. She got a pilot, and this character originally started as a recurring character. And so she had an out to go do this pilot. She went to do it, and I got the audition a day before it was supposed to happen. And
wow.
Before it was like 12 pages. And I was in the middle of pilot season at the time. I was still auditioning quite a bit because I was pretty young and fresh faced. And I called my agent and said, look, this audition's really, really important. I can't get there in time and do a good enough job. And my manager even offered her assistant to drive me so I could memorize the lines on the way. I didn't get it the night before. I got it like, it was something like the night before, but I had a test that day. I don't know. Anyway, I couldn't do a good job. So I put it off. And then they called me back in a week later and said, no, we really want to see you. Okay, so I came in, I auditioned. And actually my now father-in-law was in the room, though he wasn't my father-in-law at the time.
Right.
And I had for years been playing characters where all I had to have to audition was a pair of jeans, a tank top, and cowboy boots. And that's literally what I wore for the first 10 years of being in Hollywood.
Okay.
All those shows, I just play the girl next door.
Yeah.
So I got a call back. So I've already auditioned now for 24 after being kind of rude and pushing it off. Then I've auditioned and thinking I did a good job. And I get a call back and they say, we just need her to dress more like a grown up.
That's the only note you got?
That was like the note I got was like, we just need you to look more serious and more like a grown up. And so I went to Banana Republic and bought a suit. I didn't know.
Power suit?
Like glamorous. And I was like, okay, I don't know how to do that. And luckily they had vision.
Sure. Yeah.
And better clothes.
they could see it. Yeah. Yeah. They saw you in the role.
Yeah, but then I got the job, which was fantastic, and I was only supposed to be on for a couple episodes, and I got a lot of support from the producers, a lot of support from the writers, and a lot of support from Kiefer about my appearances in my first couple episodes, and then I was extended for quite a while. So it was a pretty big job for me. It was a really big deal for me. Not only did I get to work with such incredible actors, and Cherry Jones is like, but Glenn Morshauer, of course, who I'm sure you've already
right met. Yes, who
but also, you know, I met my husband through 24 and I have a 24 baby, so it was a pretty important show in my life.
Absolutely. That's an amazing story. So you met your husband on the set of 24?
I did not. I met him after.
Ah, okay. Okay.
When I was in jail.
Yes, right. When Olivia was in jail.
When Olivia was in jail,
yes. Olivia was in jail. John Cassar had a football party. He has one every year for the Super Bowl. And I went, and that is where I met their son and talked about sci-fi stuff all night long, specifically World War Z.
And, nice.
Yes, I'm very cool.
That's pretty cool. You remember what the conversation was about. That's awesome.
Oh, I totally remember. Because we were talking about reality. We were talking about zombie apocalypse stuff that has mythology versus just like blood and gore, which I hate. And don't call it a zombie movie for me, because then it's not. Like, I need mythology to be sci-fi. I'm a dork. Okay.
Absolutely.
So that was the conversation. Yeah.
Very cool. That's awesome. How did you get into sci-fi?
I got into sci-fi through my parents. So when I was growing up, my mom was really, really, really into Star Trek. And my dad was really, really, really not. He's from Brooklyn. She's from Oklahoma. She's an intellectual. He's an incredibly intelligent guy who grew up in the projects in Brooklyn who won't be an intellectual no matter what you tell him. Like, he just refuses.
Not gonna happen. So
he went to Star Wars.
Okay.
To try to figure out why he was like, if you're gonna watch sci-fi, at least you have to watch Star Wars. And so I became a child of both. My dad's Jewish, my mom's Christian, and my mom likes Star Trek, and my dad likes Star Wars. So
that's like a civil war.
We're a multi-family.
You're multilingual, multi-faith, multi-everything.
We're multi-faith, multi-sci-fi.
But that's civil war. I mean, the Star Wars, Star Trek has been, you know, almost since day one. And was your mom original Star Trek?
Oh, the whole thing. But yeah. Star Trek Next Gen is like her vibe.
Anyway. Mine too. I agree. Yeah.
And I mean, I like Deep Space Nine a lot. I think if my dad watched Deep Space Nine, he'd get really into that.
Sure. Yeah.
It's more reality-based than hope-based, I think.
Right. But he won't go there?
Yeah. He'll watch it if it's on, like, House Hunters.
Yeah. In the background.
Yes. If Star Wars comes on, he'll watch it. No questions asked.
That's pretty good.
And then I read all the Timothy Zahn novels when I was a kid. I got really into that. I had a boyfriend introduced me to those. And I always wanted to, you know, play Princess Leia's daughter. That was like the dream.
Wow.
So when she got cut out of the trilogy, I wasn't that sad. I mean, right. I know I'm supposed to be. But I was like, if somebody else had played that part, I would have been so sad.
Right. Somebody else didn't take it. So
I have a Jaina t-shirt. So.
Really?
Yeah.
It's true. Oh, yeah. From the original novels and the mythology and.
Yeah.
Do you have? Just curious. Do you have Splinter of a Mind of the Mind's Eye?
I'm pretty sure we have it. Yeah.
That is. Yeah, that's the one that should never have been released, because it was between. It was right after Star Wars came out in '77, and it features a showdown with Vader and Luke Skywalker.
Oh yeah, no, they should not have released that.
Yeah. I think I have. I might have two copies.
That's crazy.
I'll commit to it on the podcast. If I have an extra one and you don't have it, I will ship it to you.
Are you kidding?
Oh, absolutely not.
Oh my God.
Because we have the Gavin Booth Star Wars, the Gavin Booth Star Wars connection, and we're practically family, so.
I'm trying to look for something cool enough to send you back. I think I have something. I know I have something. I'll send you some cool 24 thing.
Oh, okay. Okay. I won't say no to that.
And,
okay.
And I'll get my father-in-law to sign it.
Very cool. Okay.
John?
Yeah, John.
Yes. Speaking of your
the author of this one.
Yes.
Yeah, that's him.
It's a great book.
Has he gave any hints recently on the future of the 24 franchise?
Dude, I can't answer that.
So is that mean that there's something in the works potentially?
Hey, Justin, you know why she can't answer that? Because Olivia Taylor's still alive. And Olivia Taylor.
No. I can't answer it because I see Kiefer sometimes. I can't answer it because I'm seeing my father-in-law on Sunday. I can't answer it because I've been working off and on for Fox since I was 21 years old. Like,
right.
Nope. It doesn't matter if I answer, I don't.
Hey, he's got to try. He's got to try.
The fact that she doesn't want to answer something. Means there could be something cooking.
She has plausible deniability.
I took a shower today too.
I went to law school, but there's a phrase I learned only from 24, and it's called plausible deniability.
Oh, totally.
And I love it because it's like, don't tell the president that, because if he gets called on it, or if Cherry Jones gets called on it, she's gonna have to answer for it. Yeah. So rather than don't tell her, because she won't have to deny that.
No, and I'm an awkwardly honest person. They don't tell me anything. Until I have a job, no one tells me anything. They're just like, yeah, it's in the mix.
Well, I mean, I'm going to back it up even further, and we'll come back to 24. But yeah. the movie Dad, I saw your name in the credits for that.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to find it to watch again. I haven't seen it. I saw it.
No. You'll understand when I explain it.
Okay.
I'm in the flashback.
Okay.
When he flashback to his life with his wife and with the kids. And Chris Lemon actually plays Jack Lemon as a younger person.
Right. Yes.
I'm his daughter.
Okay. Yeah. I'm gonna find it because when Canada got cable in the late 80s, they had this thing called Super Channel, and it was just like movies all day. And I don't even think I went to school for 2 months or 3 months when we first got it, because it was like that's all I did. I think I probably watched Dad 5 times. Like I love the interplay with Ted Danson and Jack Lemon was beautiful. And I haven't seen it It's probably in 20 years, but I want to see it again because I remember being moved by it at that point. Like, it just, like, it almost gave me more of an appreciation for my own dad and kind of changed, kind of, you know, at a young age, I was able to kind of appreciate that life is fleeting from watching that movie. So I think I'm going to watch it again as soon as I can because it was a good one. But that was one of those ones that I found. I was like, oh, you were in Dad? That's one of my favorite movies, maybe of all time. So You do. What came first? Was it 24 or a Paranormal Activity for you?
Oh, 24.
Okay. So yeah, in the time frame.
So I shot 24 and I was shooting Sons of Anarchy and 24 at the same time.
Okay.
And then and I got killed off Sons and then I went to jail on 24, but it was really funny actually because when I was getting killed off Sons, and again, a show where everybody was super supportive and was so great, and the way I got killed off, I don't know if you know the story, but no. Kurt Sutter sat me down in his office with total respect and was like, Spraggy, you're a great actress. And I was like, you are going to kill me.
This is the end.
Yeah. But it was so gracious. You know, he brought me in ahead of time. None of that weird story where, like, you don't find out till you get the script. None of that.
Right.
And he said, because I can't kill Opie.
I
can't kill Opie yet. And I was like, no, I get it. I totally understand. And, you know, these things happen. So Kim Coates, a Canadian.
Oh, yes, he is. Yep.
He really didn't want to kill me. And he was having a hard time that night. Like, walking back and forth, really upset. And I told him, I was like, look, like, I'm not dead. Like, it's okay. I am on another show.
I'll be fine. I'll be okay.
At the time, I was running back and forth shooting them. So it was like, it was actually, it was just kind of a crazy, crazy time. But so, yeah, so then I left. So then Sons ended and I was still on 24. And once we were finished at 24, it was only really a short time before I did Paranormal. It was like a summer.
Okay.
Then I started doing Paranormal.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah. I watched that again in the last couple of days. That's the movie my wife actually screamed out loud during Paranormal 2 in the theater. We're in the back row, and there was one scene where she just lost it, like she thought she was at home for a second and just
was it the kitchen or was it the dog?
Yes. It was the kitchen. That was the first time it was the kitchen with the everything opening up.
Yeah,
that was good.
They didn't tell me it was going to happen.
Really?
Yeah, no, it was great. They were like, no.
That's a genuine reaction.
It wasn't terrible, but that is a sincere reaction that you're seeing. It wasn't like they did anything terrible, but the crew, you know, in paranormal movies, they do all the special effects old school. It's all the crew, like,
right.
Pulling wires and doing this, which is really neat to watch, especially if you're coming from big, flashy shows like 24.
Right.
And, but they were like, okay, so like, when you have it, it's going to warm up. And one fire on the oven is gonna like pop, and I was like, okay,
I can handle that.
Drinking my tea, totally peed my pants. No idea what was happening. That reaction is very real. I'm terrified, and when I'm jumping up and down, like, man, what the? It's me going, are you kidding?
You didn't tell me that either. Yeah, I mean, we talk all the time about how 24 in so many ways changed television. You know, the idea that Hollywood actors generally didn't do TV before Kiefer kind of took on that role.
And
there was
Kiefer also Kiefer didn't act like a movie star on that show. He acted like the head of a theater troupe, you know. None of us are perfect. We all have our moments, but Kiefer, that show was his baby, and he took ownership of every single aspect of it, including the actors and the crew. And if you were on that show, if you showed up and you did the work, you stayed.
Right, right.
And if you showed up and you didn't do the work, you didn't stay. And it didn't matter who you were.
Yeah.
Right, right.
I really admire Kiefer for that. Anyway, I just want to say
that. The only reason I brought that up is I'm drawing the parallel from Paranormal, because the original Paranormal changed so many things. It said, you can do this budget for next to nothing. Sure. As long as your story is strong, you don't even need the CGI and all that kind of, like you said, the old school effects. You know, when I go back and watch that, it's still like the series is still scary. You know, even though I know what's happening, I still get scared.
Yeah. And I think it's amazing how it opened up how Paranormal opened up the minds of so many young people watching it too, of the things that they do, especially if their stories maybe fell outside the normal narrative. Not that Paranormal was telling some incredibly unique story, it wasn't, but the way that Oren shot it, and that the fact that he showed that you could do this in your house, you could do it with your, with what you had, with your phone, with this, I think led to so many other great projects that were filmed on phones by unknown voices. So that's a pretty cool legacy.
Yeah. I mean, certainly if you've got the story, you just need, you know, everybody's got the tools in their hands to be able to do it. You know, even going back to Olivia, the tools that you used in that season, you talk about filming, you know, the reporter, right? Blackmailing him with the information. I'm going back to 2008, 2009 phones, and I'm going, really? Could you film? Would it look grainy? Would it look clear? It's not like an iPhone. You didn't have an iPhone in 2008, 2009. I can tell you
that we only had to shoot here up.
Yeah.
So, yes, it was pretty grainy. It wasn't like a nowadays phone where it would be like a wide shot.
Right, yeah. Panoramic. Lighting, the whole deal. Yeah. No, it's, you know, it's that you use the tools at your disposal. That's one of the things I can appreciate. When we're bringing up the positive things about Olivia Taylor, is that you use the tools that you had at your disposal to get done what you needed to do.
It is interesting how many people hated her. Because I guess maybe it's because you have to be your own lawyer.
Yeah.
But for me, I was like, okay, so I'm the daughter of a powerful political family. I was out on my own doing my own thing, and now I've been dragged back into it because my brother is dead. And you want me to be in a good mood.
Right, yes.
So it's kind of like... It's
very, this is still stuck right here.
Yeah, and then I got kidnapped. But then I got to change clothes, which nobody ever gets to do in 2020.
Ever. Ever. That's pretty amazing.
But yeah, I really... I mean, I felt for Olivia, man.
What, did you see Olivia as a villain?
No. But if I think about the few characters I've ever played that I truly see as a villain, maybe like one of the killers on a procedural at some point. But when I do long arcing characters, the world may see them as villainous, but I don't see them as villainous. Otherwise, I can't play that. I have to find where that motivation comes from. And to me, the motivation for Olivia, which you saw by the end of the season when she and her mother finally break down together, is that she was just trying to protect her family the best way she knew how.
Right.
And I don't think that Olivia was motivated by something evil. I mean, she wants power, for sure.
But sure,
I think it was...
Olivia's brother was killed, right, in season 7. So she was trying to, you know, trying to get...
Revenge, get, you know, revenge is death. Yeah, absolutely. And
were you surprised on how Olivia Taylor reacted? Were you surprised on how Cherry Jones' character, President Allison Taylor, when she sent you to prison in season 7? Was that a decision that Olivia Taylor was very shocked at and supported, or?
I don't remember if Olivia was shocked. I'd have to revisit that. I personally was not shocked. I was thrilled to not be dead.
Right. You survived. You survived 24.
Which a lot of people don't. Yes.
A lot of people don't. I am still in an orange pantsuit somewhere.
You are.
I would say by now.
Or you're on parole.
Probably out.
Yeah.
Olivia probably went to jail for like 7 years. By now, she's probably out. She's probably written a few books. And she's probably become a crazy feminist, a political feminist or something, and is like, has her own TV show.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. You used, I mean, Olivia used words like eliminating problems. Can you take care of it? But she didn't, I mean, this show wasn't, you're one of the first characters that really used phrases like that. Other times they would just say, take him out. You know, get rid of them. But you didn't use some ambiguous language, and you know, just eliminate some problems. We have a problem that needs to be eliminated. And you did not transfer the money in your defense.
I did not.
You did not.
I mean, I don't think Olivia's actions were that of an angel by any means, shape, or form. I do think that contextually as well, if those characters are being written today, I don't think that Olivia would have done different things, but I think her motivation would be talked about in a different way. I think that playing a young woman who takes the reins of power and tries to protect her family at that point came off as villainous to the audience. I don't think that would come off as villainous anymore. I think that situations like that are a lot more gray nowadays.
And
that female characters on camera are a lot more gray nowadays, which is great and important. And characters in general that aren't, you know, for many years it was just white men that got to be gray.
Yeah.
The rest of us are complex people. We do complex things. And I do think Olivia is power hungry. I mean, she could also be the CEO of a, of some investment bank right now or something.
Right.
I don't think she's off, you know, saving
a work. Captain of industry.
Right. But, you know, I mean, look at Sharon on Falcon and Winter Soldier.
That was a big shocker, wasn't it?
She reminds me a lot of Olivia.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, you would hang out. You'd hang out with Sharon. Yeah, you're right. Sharon Carter. Yeah, I think so. I think so. You know, we're part of this 24 universe on a, it's a Facebook group. And it's the kind of group where we just, it's like, we'll say, hey, you got to see Sprague. She's doing the following. Or she's on Low Winter Sun. And so we'll post that and we'll get response. People will be like, oh, I didn't know that. Because for us, there's so much TV out there right now. There's so much that's being made every single day, even in the last year, that it's hard to try to keep up. And there's some really good shows. But for us, if somebody's been on 24 or part of the cast or crew or whatever, that's enough of a nugget to say, all right, we're going to check that out. We're going to follow that. So today, Christine Hernandez is one of the members of the group, and she posted a quote from season one. And there's a reason I want to bring this up. It's from Jack Bauer. That's that's his last name. It says,
are you kidding?
Well, it's a quote. It's a quote the character gave in the first season of 24.
Yeah, that's his last name.
Yeah, I forgot for a second. What's that guy's name again? Yeah, CTU. I don't know. I was kidding. Sorry. Please, Kiefer, if you're listening, Kiefer's been on the show. If Kiefer's listening, I was kidding. So the quote is, you can look the other way once and it's no big deal, except that it makes it easier for you to compromise the next time. And pretty soon that's all you're doing, compromising, because that's the way you think things are done. They weren't bad guys. They're just like you and me, except they compromised once. And so when she posted that quote today, I read it today and I went, we're going to be talking to Sprague today. And I went, that quote from season one is basically what came down to by the end of the season that you were in. Because it really came down to that conversation, that kind of through line through all the seasons of 24 to culminate to when, what was Glenn Morshower's line? I'm going to give this to the president. I'm not going to make the call. Ethan Kanan's not going to release the information publicly. We're going to give it to President Taylor, and then she's going to make a decision.
Yeah.
And then we see kind of the effects of what happens when she did make the decision, that the family, you know, another Canadian, somewhat Canadian, Comfior, right?
Yeah.
Is saying, don't do it. That's your daughter. How dare you? And you can see the severing of the relationship there because of that decision. But that decision comes from something that Jack said in season one.
Yeah.
And it came to bite you at the end because you did 7 years in a hopefully a minimum security facility.
I think it's she got tough in jail. But yeah, no, it's absolutely true. And I think also it's very pertinent to the society we live in right now.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that it's easy to find easy answers to things, but to find an easy answer to something, you have to compromise. You have to compromise your value. You have to compromise what you know is true.
Right.
You have to compromise the safety of others for things to be easy. And if it's too easy, there's a reason, you know?
Right. Right.
But it's a slippery slope, I think. Especially when...
For any of us.
Yeah, especially when you're struggling. I mean, we never know what's going on in someone else's life. But I will say, if you're, you know, I've been a successful actor and I'm very, very grateful for it. I have never, however, had some of the successes friends of mine have. And that's okay. But along the way, there have been moments where I could have compromised more to get more attention.
Sure.
And yeah. I chose not to. And that's no judgment or anything like that. But I'm just saying, in everybody's life, we are all faced with this. We all have moments when we are under challenge, whether it be financial or family or social or work, whatever it is for you personally, where there is an easy option, but that will take you down a road that will be much harder to come back from. And that's right. An extremely difficult choice, especially if there are people relying on you.
Which really makes the decision so powerful at the end, because again, it's your flesh and blood. You know, how many of us would do that in that same situation, right? If we were presented with the idea of sending our own child to jail, I mean, I'd have a really hard time with that.
And Carrie and Kong, they're such incredible actors who are so grounded in reality. And 24 did such a wonderful job of knowing itself. You know, the producers and the writers, they really knew what they were making. Yeah. And so they understood that on paper, the words were going to come off as perhaps overdramatic, perhaps, you know, a little crazy, perhaps right. Because you're constantly in crazy situations, right?
Right, yeah.
So what I think, one of the things I admired so much about what they did and the actors I was surrounded by was that they were such incredible, grounded, anchored actors in reality. And I mean, literally, Calm and Cherry, every moment, no matter what had to come out of their mouth, sounded so real and so incredible. And I would just try to keep up and be like, okay, don't make it a big deal when I say, well, when I was kidnapped and the bomb came through. Like, it was such an incredible acting challenge in that regard, because you have to get out this information. But because, right. And it starts at the top, because Kiefer played it so well and with such reality and cared so much for the work. You had to find a way to make these extreme situations very real. And I think Carrie and Calm really played the grief of grieving parents. They played that so well. And to have a grieving parent have to give up the other child is, I mean, I know that for my parents, you know, we lost my brother a long time ago. And for my parents, even watching that scene was extremely hard for them. Carrie and Calm did such a good job.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, film has that way to convey those, you know, the emotions and kind of bring us back to situations for sure.
That's sorry.
Yeah. Speaking of compromised characters, Low Winter Sun. I live in Windsor. I'm sure there was a scene. I remember I said to my wife, I think I can see our house from the riverside shot because it was kind of right there. I said, that might be. You lived, and that was shot in Detroit completely.
It was shot in Detroit. I lived up by the DIA, through the Arts.
Yes.
You know, that there, I don't know if it's still there, but there is this beautiful, I know the building's still there. This
okay.
Beautiful
yeah.
Old apartment building that's right next to the DIA.
Okay.
If you're facing up on the street and the DIA is on your right, the building, okay. Like literally next to it, the building has this wonderful crepe restaurant in it.
Hmm.
They just made crepe.
Really?
Know. But, and then it's across from the university. I loved it. I loved everything about Detroit. I absolutely adored it.
Had you spent time there before that?
Never.
And really?
It was incredible. I mean, I grew up in Boston, and then I lived in New York for many years. And just being having that little bit of the East Coast back, even though it's also Midwest, and so
right.
Behind, which is unnerving.
Sure. New York. Right. Yeah.
But it was. I just. What an incredible place. I mean, the art alone. The art that is just exploding. It's like pouring out of houses. Like you can see a burnt out house with like the most amazing piece of art down.
I mean, you were near the Fisher Building. You were near so many landmarks in that city that, I mean, if you were right in that heart of it. And I got to tell you, it's transformed so much even since you were there.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, that's been a while. That's been like 10 years now. It was in such an incredible moment of growth and seeing the community come together to support this growth. I was there when Whole Foods opened.
Yes.
But cool.
Right by Music Hall. Yeah. That was a big deal. That was a big deal. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. No, there's been so much change. I haven't been over there in a year, unfortunately. I can see it from my balcony, but I haven't been over there in a year. But the change that's happened over the last 10 to 12 years is just unbelievable. I mean,
the citizens of Detroit are amazing. Those are some tough, incredible people who love the place that they are connected to, and they will do everything they can to save it. And there, I mean, you'd read a review of an amazing restaurant. You go to the restaurant, and the front is somebody's house.
Right, right.
Restaurant's in the backyard, and you're like, okay, cool. Or run out of someone's kitchen because the infrastructure was falling apart, and the people of Detroit were like, well, we'll just save it ourselves. And it, I mean, I just, I admire them all so much.
It's it's an incredibly resilient city. I grew up there as a kid, and so there's parts of the areas that you mentioned that I remember as a kid, you wouldn't walk on the streets. And I remember I was there 2 years ago, there was a Third Man Records, which is Jack White's record label, is kind of, he's built a vinyl pressing plant right on Canfield, right down there.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing somebody riding a bike down the street, and I'm going, you can't ride your bike around here. Didn't you see the movie Detroit? This isn't good. This isn't good. But yeah,
now there's a fancy hipster bike store on Canfield.
Yeah, and dog parks. I'm like, there's dog parks in downtown Detroit. But it's been cool to see. And it sounds like you were kind of there right as things were starting to really shift.
It was a privilege, honestly. Yeah. It was a privilege to really be a part of that community. And we had all decided as a cast that we wanted to live in the city proper.
Right, right.
Really experience it.
Yeah, you could have gone to the suburbs. I mean, there's lots of places.
Yeah, and other shows had done that, and we had heard from crew members that they felt that the actors not having the experience of the city meant that they didn't bring the experience of the city to the show. So we tried our best to make sure that we really got to know those people, and it really truly was a privilege.
And how long were you there?
About 3 months, I think.
Oh, great! Yeah, that's a good
10 episodes, 2.5 months.
Yeah, that's a good time to get to know that city for sure.
It was heartbreaking not to go back. I'm not gonna lie. I think we all felt that way. We've all moved on in a variety of ways, and we're all doing cool things. But
yeah,
there were certain aspects of that show and of being there at that moment that the majority of us would say that we would love to go back to.
Yeah.
So, what is it about acting that you find fulfilling and that you love about it? And is there any advice you would give to a student wanting to get into the acting business?
Sure. Again, if I talk too much, just cut me off. I talk a lot.
Oh, no worries. No. I mean, you were part, again, like 20 years later, you were part of a groundbreaking show, 24, which still works these days. So, I mean, I think you've done a lot of amazing work. So I think your opinion and value would be, you know, is always appreciated.
Well, I can say that, you know, I didn't come from an acting family. I didn't come from an entertainment family. So I had to pull myself up by my own bootstraps and do this completely on my own. And it doesn't mean I didn't get help along the way. Of course I did. And also, you know, as a white woman, I already came from a point of privilege because that's where the majority of the opportunities were for white women at the time I came up. However, I will say, that the professionalism I see from all the actors across the board that are successful right now, that is what is needed. That's one of the biggest pieces of advice I'd give anyone, first of all. And I'll get to why I love it. But, you know, be 5 minutes early, know your lines. These are easy things. Yeah, and what you find is that the people who bring that to set are the ones who truly want to be there. And right now, one of the amazing things that's happening in the business is that opportunities have been opened up and you have truly talented people who are working, not just because they're beautiful on camera, but because they are truly talented. And many of them happen to be very pretty. Yet. But especially women of color, especially men of color, especially trans actors who are coming out of the woodwork, telling their story. And I'll tell you something, they are professional.
Sure.
Because they want to be there. They have been ready. They've been held back for years and they're ready to fly. And, it's changed, I think, a lot of the dynamic on a lot of shows. There's a lot more professionalism in the industry in general, which is really wonderful to be around because it is a job. And it's a job that hundreds of people are relying on you to do. If you're 5 minutes late, the crew didn't get 5 minutes of sleep.
Right.
Nobody gets to work then. So that would be one piece of advice I would have. Always, I mean, these are simple. I know. I'm sorry. Always say please. Always say thank you. Always say you're sorry because someday you're going to be over dramatic and you're going to have a bad day and they better believe you when you say you're sorry that day.
Right, right.
But in general, starting out, I don't know any advice. I have a hard time talking to people about when they're starting out now because, like you say, there's so much opportunity, which is so incredible, but there's also such a din of people trying to get in that I'm not really sure if you have to go through social media or if you have to go through an agent. I would say training is always good. I didn't personally go to a theater conservatory. However, I did train in New York City, and that was quite helpful. And I made sure I was always in class, especially in the beginning of my career. And those connections that you make in class to other actors, or, you know, to people who want the same thing that you want. I personally was in a class with a bunch of working actors. That's what I wanted. I wanted to be a character actor. I didn't, being famous was not something I necessarily wanted or was going after. It wasn't my priority. I'm a very socially awkward person, which you can tell from all of my red carpet. but I guess that kind of leads into what I will say that I love about acting is, for me personally, acting is the time when my brain goes quiet.
Sure. Yeah.
When I am in on a set and I'm playing a different character and I can completely sink into that character, it's the moment in my life where I don't doubt anything about myself. And I constantly am doubting myself. That's just who I am. It's not like a feel bad thing. It just is what it is.
Yeah. It's who you are. Yeah.
I'm a socially awkward person who like doesn't know what to do during interviews, or I've been doing this 20 years. I don't know what to wear. I have a panic attack. I don't know how to do my hair. It's just, that's who I am.
Yeah.
And when I go to work, somebody else picks what I wear. Somebody else picks my hair. And then all I need to do is totally become this other person and clearly know their motivation. And it is, it's a great catharsis for me. It's also just fun.
And has the pandemic affected you professionally at all? And how have guided your way through the pandemic in a professionally?
It definitely affected me, and not in a way that was personal necessarily. But for example, I was on a show. I was recurring on A Million Little Things, and my storyline, unfortunately, and they were very cool about it. They were very professional, but all the American guest stars in my storyline got cut. Because
they shoot in Canada?
They shoot in Canada.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, yeah.
And at the time, my boss, you know, told me flat out, he was as honest as he could be about this.
Yeah,
and, you know, love you, we're not killing you.
I was like, right.
That's cool.
Things are going to change. Yeah.
But it was factual. I mean, they have a very large cast, and it was like, we can't quarantine this many people. There's only a certain amount we can do, and we have to have them for the storylines at the back end of the season, because that's how Million Little Things works, right? A couple big storylines, and then they lead into another one. And they were able to, you know, luckily they were able to cast the characters they needed locally, and fantastic for those actors, you know. But that was a bit of a blow, because I didn't get to finish the story, and I think that's always hard for me when I don't. Anytime you lose a job and you're freelance, it's hard. Let's just
absolutely.
But also, when you don't get to see through the story and know what happened to that character, that's kind of the reason with Low Winter Sun that it still kills me, because I know what Maya was going to do in season 2.
There was more story.
Maya was going to take over.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I watched the finale again this morning, and because it's making me want to go back and watch it all from the beginning again, which is what I'm going to do. But yeah.
I can't imagine how amazing it would have been if she had taken over, and what that story would have led to, and the moments that story would have led to with her and the dancers and the prostitutes and the cops and the other people in Detroit that she was working with, and having the dynamic of this white woman come in. But also, I just loved Maya. I loved how she had no sentimentality. I was playing that was like that scene where she lets her children go was probably one of the most freeing scenes I've ever played in television.
I've never seen you play anything anywhere near that role.
It was amazing. Well, because women don't get to play that. Right. Women don't get to play that we're not interested in saving our kids.
Right. Yeah.
And we don't get to play that we don't just care about our husband's rise. And seeing Maya evolve after her husband died, and seeing what happened in those moments, and seeing—I just wanted her to.
There were plans. There were plans.
Really excited about it.
Yeah. No, I mean,
I would love to play a character like that again. But those are the things I love about acting, and I also love. But I, you know, like with Dirty John, one of the things that was.
Yes. Thank you.
Oh, no, it's okay. You're talking about acting.
That's where my head was going. Sorry. No, please.
No, I'll shut up. I'm talking too much.
No. Dirty John was where I was going to go next.
Dirty John was really amazing for me, because it was also coming off of a time when I had had my son.
Okay.
I couldn't get a job to save my life. It's the business.
Right.
It's no one's fault. This is what happens. I disappeared for 9 months. I had a baby, and then I bought a house because my dad was like, "It's a really good time to buy a house." And he was like, "But it's a really good time." And I was like, "Okay." 6 months in, I'm in a house. I don't have income. I have a baby, and I'm like, "Oh man, I got to get a job." So, luckily, I ended up basically crying on like every show on network TV, and people were just really cool about it. And you know, I would say again, be polite, be on time, because if you ever have a bad moment, those people will come and save you and give you work. But then Dirty John really was first 7 seconds, and then Dirty John was really the transition to getting back to where I feel comfortable, to the place where I live.
Right. Yeah.
And that character, playing Tanya, was, again, a giant privilege. Also because Tanya is a real person.
Right, right.
Tanya is a real person I spent hours and hours on the phone with. Tanya's a real person who opened up her life to me. And it was such... When she saw the episodes and she told me that she could... And she told me that she felt that her daughters and she could finally explain to people the terror they've been living in because they could show those episodes. That was such a... It was such an incredible moment, and I'm not really sure how to talk about that, except to say that it was such a joy and it was such a privilege to work with Eric, to work with Alexander Cunningham, to work with Jeff, the director, and to bring what this woman had gone through to life in a way where after 20 years, she still felt she couldn't explain to people what had happened to her because it was so much coercive control.
Right. The shame involved, the, you know, the embarrassment.
She painted it in a way where people just didn't believe her.
Right, right.
And she was one of the few women, and this is nothing against the other women that he
died. Right, right, right.
They all went through hell. But she was one of the few that put her foot down and said, no.
Yeah, no, yeah, yeah.
I'm going to stop this now. And I mean, her telling me about how every morning she and her daughters would get into their garage, and she always parked in the garage so that she could turn the car on in the garage so that if he was outside, she could run him over.
Right, right. I believe it.
That was, yeah, that was
I believe it.
She's an incredible person. And her kids are incredible.
So in my normal pre-COVID days, and I'm doing this now online for schools, but I'm the person that travels to schools and talks about social media safety. So I talk to parents groups, I talk to kids, I do all that kind of stuff. And one of the groups I talk to is seniors groups, and I get the romance scam stories. And so when Dirty John, I listened to the podcast when it was on, I was in my head, I'm still shocked at how recent that story was, because it was literally like, it happened in like, what, 14 or 15. And then the podcast came out a year later. And then the show came out right after. Usually those shows are like, the Betty Broderick story is 25 years old, right?
Yeah.
I remember hearing about that story when I was a kid. I remember that. But the first story, and I can't remember her name, but the first story was like yesterday. And by the way, it's now a TV show. And so from what I do and how I warn people about that kind of stuff, I said, everybody in the world has to watch Dirty John. Like if you literally don't watch anything else on Netflix, you have to find Dirty John and you have to watch this, because it puts you in the place and helps you to say, because there's so many voices that are like, come on. And I've heard people say this, how did she fall for that? It was so obvious. And I'm like, this show, it's a film. It takes you into and puts you in her place and helps you to realize where she was at and where his former wives were at. And it helps, as a guy who generally has a hard time understanding those kind of things, it puts you in the place where you go, oh my gosh. Yeah. How could she not have fallen for this?
And Alexander Cunningham, the creator, has a very special gift when it comes to portraying coercive control. She really has this ability to write these shows that demonstrate how the little behaviors that happen that then become and control you. And that is something that I can't speak for men, but I can say for women in our experience, somebody's always pushing just to take a little bit more. We just want a little bit more. And for years that was okay, because we were less than. And many people still see women that way. And you're taught from the time you're very young that men are going to try to just push just a little bit, little bit, little bit each time. And so when you get so conditioned to that, it's very easy to fall into an abusive situation. I mean, I definitely had my connections with not nice boyfriends.
Right, right.
Definitely verbal abuse, especially when I was grieving, you know, things that happened in my family. And you can't ever judge anyone who's in one of those situations, men.
Absolutely not.
Because you just don't know. You don't know the small little details that takes to get there. And that's
the little steps.
It's little things here and there, little bit, so that when you start to question, like Tanya, it gets turned around on you, like, oh, you're just going to give up on our family. You don't believe in me after 15 years. I mean, she was with this guy for 10 years and nothing happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as we watched Dirty John, it was like, she'd go, I need to take a break. And she would explain why she needed to take a break, because it was so close to home. It brought something back from like 15 years ago. But that personality or lack of personality is so prevalent that story. That's why I say, I don't care if you haven't, you've got to watch it today. I told my mom, watch that story, because my mom counsels a lot of people as well. I said, you will understand more how somebody can be in that situation and then not realize and not be able to see the surface, right? They're in the hole. And I said, for a guy, we have to be able to allow film and TV to put us in the position where we can start to, will I ever fully understand the feeling that she felt? Of course not. But I need to get closer to that. It's empathy, right?
And I think that's something that's evolving in entertainment, which I find very, very exciting. Even, you know, we're telling other stories. We're not just telling that story of that one group of people anymore. We're starting to tell the story across the board. And, you know, telling the Betty Broderick story from Betty's point of view.
Right,
That's not how that was painted at the time. You know, and telling Dirty John in a way that, yes, you know, targeted some of the women that he attacked. And not targeted, but, like, she didn't make it black and white. It wasn't that the women were completely innocent either.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, that situations are complicated. However, the fact is there are just certain abuses in general in society. The smallest, you know, even the smallest thing, stealing someone's cab, getting in line in front of somebody, saying, well, I'm not going to wear my mask, even though you're wearing your mask. These little things that we do to each other on a daily basis, they're bred out of privilege. They're bred out of a lack of community, a lack of caring. And I think the more that we highlight these things, the more that we empathize by showing other stories, the more that we open it up and show the story that doesn't normally get heard, or that we change the perspective of the story that's being told and tell it from the narrator who doesn't normally get listened to. The more we do that, the better our kids will be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we want to thank you for being part of telling those stories, because they have impact. They have impact. I mean, certainly. Yeah, I mean, we appreciate you taking the time to hang with us, and that you've opened our eyes in so many different ways and give us such a unique perspective on not just 24, but everything that you've been a part of and everything that you're going to continue to be a part of. So thank you very much for that.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. It was so kind of you to have me on. I really appreciate it, and been some really good company.
Typical barrister.